Well, welcome, everyone.
Hello.
A few folks with me?
Hello.
We're back.
Yep.
Very good. So I just wanted to welcome everyone to this call on January the 24th. And as Tamara usually does, she's unfortunately not able to join us at least at the beginning of this call, so I'm sort of taking the duties over for today. And as she normally does, we sort of ask for any announcements. Does anyone have any announcements? Wow, nothing's happening?
Well, no, too much is happening. Can't summarize.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think the exchange that's been going on in the last 24 hours is just fascinating.
And I
had several people who expressed interest in this advisory committee that I've been asked to suggest names for. So as I've been telling everybody, I will forward the information, but I have no control over this. But there is something that I think is a wonderful opportunity that I want to toss out and mm-hmm. see if there are any suggestions. And if you think it's worthwhile, I'll send a note to everybody by email afterwards. But been asked...
Karen, I wonder whether you could just introduce yourself, because most of us, many of us
sure,
know...
Sure, if you don't know my voice. This is Karen Holweg, and I'm in Boulder, Colorado. And I've been asked by people who are working on the development of an international large-scale assessment that will be assessing science and environmental literacy in 2015, whether I know of any good stimulus materials for items about climate change that might be included in an international assessment. And I said to myself, wow, what an opportunity. Because we always talk about how some of the formal mechanisms in both our country and internationally don't stress climate change enough. And I think if we can suggest some really great, I'm thinking especially of graphics, visuals,
mm-hmm.
that might serve as a stimulus item for either one or a series of items on an assessment. For instance, a graph that students would need to be able to read the graph and garner information from it and then answer some questions, or some other kind of graphic that presents data and then would lead one to asking questions or suggesting relationships or something else.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, do any of you have any favorite graphics or other things that you use in your pursuits that you think might be useful in this setting? And if so, could you send them to me?
But of course.
Who's that? I don't recognize the voice.
That's Doug Cohen in New Mexico.
Gary. Oh, of course, Doug. Hi.
Gary Brosh, our partner and members, some of his photographs are just larger than life.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that'd be interesting. Some of the before and after photos.
Mm-hmm.
And the people in the South Pacific Islands who are losing their homeland.
Yep.
There's an amazing one of that was at the AAAS gallery.
Oh, yes.
Anyway, that's just one that comes to mind.
There is a series recently that someone had sent around, John Cook, the skeptical scientist, had put together four images that are eight, I believe, key messages, and they're really useful, I would say.
Do you have a link or something that you could send?
Yeah, I can send that to you, Karen.
That'd be great. Is this Kirsten?
This is Kristen, yeah.
Kristen.
Yep.
Cool.
We have some, this would be graphs of water loss of glaciers in South America that the Peru Water Authority uses. And so it shows like 10 different high elevation glacier melt rates.
Cool. And if I send out a notice to everybody, can you shoot back to me a link or the graphics?
Sure.
Yeah,
wonderful.
That's
could you share those when you get them?
Well, the other choice is for everybody to just send it back to the whole listserv.
Yeah.
Is that too much, Scott, or is that...
It really depends on folks, you know, whether that's too much volume. But it should be fine. Certainly no problem technically.
Okay.
Great.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I mean,
okay, well, I'll send out a brief notice after the call is over, and that'll make it easy for all of you to just respond and send me and the rest of the listserv the answer if you think it would be of interest to everybody.
Yeah, that can be a choice. If folks just want to send it to you directly, that's great, too, or just CC everyone. That'd be great.
Good.
It sounds like a great opportunity. And Aaron, if you have sort of a little bit more material about what you know how this thing is setting up for 2015, that would be really interesting too. I think.
Well, I won't until some more internal decisions are made in the next few months. But this is a preliminary chance that I just thought was too good to jump on.
Absolutely.
Not to jump on.
Excellent. So any other questions or announcements or even commentary on some of the stuff that's been going on the listserv and sort of trying to create a visual representation of human impact on the atmosphere?
Well, this is Doug. One, I just heard yesterday in a board call of Sustainability Education NGO or that the EPA is doing these thought leader gatherings. Has anybody been alerted or heard about that? Because we would want to make sure some climate science knowledge is showing up in these sustainability education thought leader sessions of the EPA. Is that news to everybody or anyone heard of it yet?
I haven't heard anything.
Up to the Lisa Jackson level, there's a number of them they've been doing. One of them was held at the NCSE conference last week with David Blockstein.
Okay.
But there's more coming, so that's just an interesting thing that they're doing.
I just fairly recently became aware of the EPA's Environmental Education Committee. I'm drawing a blank on the exact name, but I've got it here somewhere. Which I've applied to serve on. The deadline was last week or 2 weeks ago or something like that.
Yes, I threw my hat in the ring too. That's an advisory council or something?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was encouraged to do that. I didn't even know it existed.
Yeah, me too. Yep. Me too.
So I just sent something in. But, you know, I think people like us need to be aware of these opportunities, so... Thanks for sharing.
Great. So anything else you want to share? Well, as I think everyone knows, we have a presentation today from Jeff Ryan. And as you've probably seen on the bio, Jeff is a professor and the chair of the geology department at the University of South Florida in Tampa. And he's the principal investigator with this CCEP One partnership project, that's the word I'm looking for. And it's called Coastal Areas Climate Change Education Partnership. That's what they call themselves. And Jeff's going to talk to us for this morning and this afternoon, depending on our time zone. So take it away, Jeff.
Okay.
I'm assuming everyone has the slides. The slides are on the in two formats on the webpage. So, very
right.
Good.
Okay. Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk about our project here, the Coastal Areas Climate Change Education Partnership. I can take no credit for the title and the acronym. We have a co-PI in the project, Alan Feldman, from our secondary education department at the University of South Florida, who's big on acronyms. And so he was the one who came up with the catchy acronym here. We are one of the 15 CCEP Phase 1 projects. And obviously, y'all are probably familiar with the goals of the CCEP program to pursue innovative approaches to teaching and learning about climate change, develop new strategies to increase adoption of effective educational resources and practices across a range of stakeholders. There were some explicit deliverables that the Phase 1 projects were supposed to provide, two in particular, sort of to generalize it. One is an expanded partnership, and the second is an implementable strategic climate education plan. Obviously, these are either regionally or topically focused partnerships. Ours is is both regional and topical in nature. Moving to the second slide beyond, well, I guess it's slide three now, but just to tell you who CACHI is, who are the partners we're engaged with. And we've taken sort of the approach in defining partners is as people who are doing things with us and we're doing things with them. So it's sweat equity partnership. And so we have several institutions who were funded as part of the phase one effort. The University of South Florida involves faculty in five different colleges in the university and one international center. The University of Puerto Rico at Mayagüez, the University of the Virgin Islands came in as a third academic partner during the supplement request. We brought them in on supplement dollars. We also have an informal science partner in the form of Polar Aquarium, and our K-12 education partner is the Hillsborough County Public Schools. These are the folks who get money from the NSF grant, but we have a variety of other strategic cooperating partners, the logos for which are laid down below. They range from local planning councils to other federally funded projects, COSI Florida. You can read these for yourself. I'm going to be talking about each of them as we move along here because they're all involved in different activities with us. And I think last time I heard one of these talks, people were asking where people are located. They like that Google Earth map idea. Well, this is the most recent Google Earth map in this next slide of where people are. And so we have a lot of partners, both funded and strategic, in Florida. We have partners in the Caribbean, not just in the U.S. Caribbean, but also internationally here. It's hard to disentangle the U.S. territories and their needs and activities from the rest of the Caribbean, and we just haven't really tried. And there's a lot to learn from the folks in that part of the world about climate change and its impacts. Also on this slide is the link to our website. So if you want to see a little bit more about what we're doing, there's CACHI.net as the website, and we also have a Facebook page. Got to have all those communication avenues. So next slide here. And this is a slide I typically put up when I talk about why CACHI, and one could ask the question, why CSAP? And I think that it is to some degree, and this is me personally talking here, a de facto admission by federal agencies that the usual messages didn't work. They haven't been working. We haven't been making the impact on the world and the community, particularly in the U.S., that we need to in terms of this issue. And so new ideas and strategies are required for effective public communication and education on climate change. From the beginning, the content emphasis for the CACHI partnership has really been on things that are happening now and in the very near future. We are not, we really don't spend a lot of time talking about what's going to happen 100 years out, because in Florida, things are happening now, okay? And we're very focused on the impacts of those things. So sea level rise, big issue in Florida. Changes in weather patterns, storm events, precipitation changes, all of those make a difference to us. Obviously, issues explicitly of the coastline, coastal erosion, damage, beach loss, these are things that to a state heavily indebted to the tourism industry, and also if we go to Puerto Rico, we go to the Virgin Islands, equally involved with the tourism industry, these things matter. And one that maybe isn't as clear from at first blush but is really important is water resource problems. Availability, water quality, all of these are affected. And we do talk a lot and engage with folks who talk a lot about resiliency strategies, okay? How do you adapt? How do you mitigate? How do you plan for what's going to happen? Because you can't really talk about the long term to folks who are having short term catastrophes, and Florida, of course, has had more than its share in this regard, as well as the other Caribbean states. And so we sort of have, I guess, gelled over this project on a message, okay, which is that for this region, the impacts of climate change are a problem of the here and now. We have to focus with our different stakeholder communities on these near-term impacts so that folks have the knowledge they need to make the decisions they're going to have to make about what they're going to do in the next few years, okay? And we have focused very strongly on what we call the issues and the audiences of the built environment. So not so much on, shall we say, what's happening in the Everglades, but very much so on what's happening in Miami or San Juan or cities that are right on the water, okay, because those issues are acute. We've sort of focused, I guess, over the course of this project, we focused on sort of three general stakeholder audiences. K-12 educators, informal science educators, and what I lump together as built environment professionals, talking a lot with urban and regional planners, beginning to talk more with policy professionals. It's sort of like tying the knot there, because the planners talk to the policy folks, and that's where the decisions are made, and both groups need content, they need help, they need support. We're also talking to professionals in the tourism industry, looking at tourism organizations, but also folks on the ground in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands and even in Florida, and beginning to even broaden out to other professionals who play a role here, engineers, architects, and others involved in the construction and maintenance of urban areas. Okay, next slide. These were the five goals that CACI laid out in its proposal, and we've largely hewed to these. We, like every CSEP, did an assay of existing climate change education resources. In our case, we targeted those related to our service area, Florida, the Caribbean, and more generally, coastal regions across the world. Okay, we wanted to find that kind of content because we figured that was going to be relevant to us. We have been engaging key players and stakeholder groups, both in terms of developing survey instruments and putting out surveys to gather constituent perceptions. I'll talk a bit more about those in further slides, and also information about their educational needs and delivery methods. So what do they need to know, and how can we get it to them? Okay, we've piloted a number of different strategies in formal and informal climate education, and are working to identify areas for further research on effective practices. Some of these have come out of the pilots, and obviously we're, like every other CSEP, developing a climate change education plan, and based on the data we've collected, our stakeholder needs, and on what we know from best practices in education and outreach. So moving on to the slide that says assaying existing climate change education resources related to Florida, Caribbean, and coastal regions. If you want to see what we found here, this was our first task, and we pulled a lot of stuff together. You can go to our website, and there's a button up at the upper left that says Go to Resources, and you can actually, that will dump you into a USF Libraries information portal that is being provided to the project by our libraries here at the University of South Florida. This is a business they're in. They don't charge us anything for it. It's just a place we can put stuff and get it out there for our community to see and for the public to take advantage of. What's the results of this assay? It's sort of shocking how little there is that really good, how little there is in the way of learning materials of any sort that focus on issues at the coastline. Okay, that has been sort of a galling thing for us, is there's really very little out there. There's a tremendous amount. We heard the talk a couple weeks ago about the polar CSEP, and there's a tremendous amount of content out there talking about what's happening in cold places, about polar regions. Obviously, there's some really compelling imagery that comes here. But if you're going to talk to people in Miami or people in San Juan who have never seen a polar bear and probably never will, we need to be able to talk to them about things that they care about, and there's really not much there, okay? And the problem just gets worse when we move into Spanish, because that's a fundamental part of what we do in this project. We have to deal across two languages. However, there is a lot of good and accessible information out there that's been pulled together for non-scientific audiences, usually policy audiences, focused on climate change. And I've got one of the documents, just the front page of one of these documents that was developed by our FAU partner, focusing on water resources in South Florida. There's that kind of content out there, but nothing that's really ready for a classroom, nothing that's ready for the different stakeholder audiences we're talking about. So there's a significant need to repurpose existing content and do some things in this regard. Okay, so next slide. Beginning to talk a little bit about what we've done in the K-12 arena, talking to teachers and students both in Florida and Puerto Rico. We've sent out surveys. The numbers that are on the survey, actually, I think were a little bit old. That's the last numbers I had. There's more that have come in since then. So we've covered quite a large number of teachers in Florida and in Puerto Rico. We have found things out about these teachers and their perceptions of climate change that are perhaps unsurprising. There's a lot of misconceptions out there amongst the folks in middle schools and high schools about the causes of climate change. You can see one of them here, the idea that the depletion of the ozone layer is affecting climate change. And We also found a significant number of misperceptions related to the nature of science in terms of how climate science is done, and what we can count as a valid scientific outcome, which, you know, is at one level an obstacle in terms of getting this content across to teachers in a way that they can then present to students. But the thing that really caught my eye out of the survey results is the time on task, okay? Not a lot of time is being spent on climate change in Florida or Puerto Rico classrooms, but it's truly terrifying how little time is being spent on it in Florida, okay? Half the teachers in Florida, about a third in Puerto Rico, only mention it briefly in their classrooms. These are science teachers. These are folks doing marine science courses. These are folks doing life science courses, places where this should come up. And significant fractions are not covering it at all. Of those who are covering it, there's a tremendous divergence in time on task. In Puerto Rico, they actually do spend a couple weeks a year. That's in their curricula. They talk about climate change explicitly and the impacts it will have. As an island state, an island commonwealth, that makes some sense. In Florida, 2 to 3 days a year is coming back. And, you know, my own, shall I say, skeptical read on that kind of result is basically what they're saying is, we're not covering it, okay? We're not talking about this at all. And that's really a big problem here, okay? We have student surveys. Actually, they've gone out. They've come back. They're currently being milled through by one of our co-PIs in this project, Ben Herman, in our secondary education department at USF. And so I don't have any outcomes for those yet, but a lot of what he said so far is that misperceptions are very similar to students to teachers. So what are we doing for this formal education audience? Here's some of the activities and outreach efforts we've made on the next slide. We planned a sort of curricular injection strategy. In Florida, as with many states, much of what happens in science curricula, particularly at the high school level, is wired to the assessment tests. In our case, it's the FCAT test. And so it's really, really hard to get new content or different kinds of content into, say, a chemistry class or a biology class or some of the more traditional science classes. But one thing that we can do in Florida that may be a little unique is there is an elective science class that's incredibly popular, marine science, that's offered in pretty much every school district in the state and in all the larger school districts. And the curriculum in that class, while still bound to state standards, is not taught to the test. It's something that is actually developed by the educators. They settle on the kinds of things they're going to cover every year in that course, and there's a communication amongst the marine science educators across the state. And so we took part in a curriculum planning workshop for the county marine science educators in Hillsborough County back in July, essentially spent a full day with them, giving them content on climate change, talking about strategies. They brainstormed. We helped vet some of the things that they were talking about. And we're basically watching the outcome. So these are teachers who have gone back, and they're now going to build this into their courses, and we want to see how effective this is. We've gotten some interest from other school districts who heard about this effort in doing the same thing for them, and we're trying to actually line up some of the bigger Florida school districts to take part in this going forward. We've done a showcase and symposium event, a sort of afternoon evening event aimed at all the teachers in Hillsborough County, and others from other counties who are welcome to come. We did this back in November. It included a lot of climate science professionals giving presentations in different aspects of it. It included folks like the electric company talking about their strategies and dealing with carbon emissions. It, you know, covered a lot of ground, and had a lovely keynote from the author of one of the most popular biology textbooks that's used in high schools today. Actually came down and gave a keynote for the teachers to sort of pep them up on moving forward. It was a very nice event. We've also done stuff in Puerto Rico, and I'll talk more about this later. We've run a number of sort of half-day and day-long workshops and events for both climate change educators, scientists, and other community members in Puerto Rico. That's been a way we reached out there so far. And there have been a number of presentations targeting educators, both at the recent IEEE Engineering Conference and at the most recent ASTE meeting, which was actually held here in St. Petersburg. One pilot I do want to talk about that we're doing at the K-12 level that actually cuts across some of these stakeholder audiences is a research and learning kind of pilot that my co-PI, Alan Feldman, calls Multiple Outcome Interdisciplinary Research and Learning. multiple outcomes because it involves people and organizations working together without necessarily having the same goals, okay? All working on the same problem but for different reasons. Interdisciplinary in that it builds an expertise from more than one discipline and actually from more than one institution. It involves often, on the cases we're doing these things, it involves a couple different organizations. And research and learning, because the assumption here is that people learn when engaged in research. And so this is a piloting exercise we've done. We proposed this in the grant request to see how effectively we can teach different groups of cohorts of students and educators about climate change through engaging them in the actual investigations of climate-related scientific issues. So to the next slide, just this sort of graphic and description here that we have for the multiple outcomes, interdisciplinary, and again, my co-PI, Alan Feldman, is fond of acronyms, and his acronym for this one is MOIRL. So the MOIRL pilot is, as he calls it, transdisciplinary, in that the project includes expertise from inside and outside the university. It's not just an academic exercise. We're involving students, K-12, college and graduate students. We're involving teachers as well as education researchers. We're involving informal science educators, scientists, engineers, the actual research, the actual investigators themselves, also business and industry in some cases, and policymakers and community members in some of these exercises. So on to a couple examples here. I've got two I want to talk to you about. We've got about half a dozen of these pilot projects going on now. Each of them is being evaluated. We're actually evaluating student and teacher perceptions before and after and during to sort of document change in perception and change in understanding of issues related to climate. This particular project is quite a lot of fun because it also ties together our service area nicely. It's looking at cave deposits and climate change at the Camuy Caves National Park in Puerto Rico. The climate scientist is actually Bogdan Onak, who I believe is actually on the call here. He is from the geology department at USF, a world expert on the study of caves and the use of cave stone, drip stones, as an indicator of climate. We have a graduate student from secondary education, Vanessa Vernaza Hernandez. She's here at USF as a graduate student, but she is also Puerto Rican, and she is connected into the school districts there through familial connections. So she helped actually make some of the handshakes here to get this going. And we have three different Puerto Rican teachers, two from high schools and one from a middle school, who are involved with their students in this effort. And the purpose of the project is to help students understand how cave deposits can provide clues to climate change, how we can track change in climate through the caves, even change in sea level in some cases through what we see in caves. And so the hope here is that the students will learn through the study of caves how they can find information on climate change over time and how it can be used to predict future changes on climate and sea level. Okay, so what happened in this project? A very brave man, Dr. Onak, and these teachers, 90 students from the three participating schools did an educational visit to this national park. Cooperating, obviously, and I didn't list as cooperating, but definitely they were, as the people running the national park, the rangers, et cetera, were obviously very helpful. The students learned about different aspects of cave formation, structure, and characteristics of the caves from Dr. Onak, from Ms. Fernanda Hernandez, and the teachers, and also how information about climate change can be extracted from the study of caves. And they actually participated in installing data loggers, okay, to measure temperature and relative humidity, both inside and outside the cave, for a year. And data on drip water and precipitation is being collected at two-week periods. We have some help down in Puerto Rico to get that out. And these are going out to be analyzed chemically, which will then, this data will actually become the basis of student classroom efforts to produce climate-focused signage for the Camuy Caves display. So there's going to be a feedback into what happens in this informal science venue. And this is sort of the grand ambition of the MOIRL project, is that we're going to create informal, the students are going to get educated, the teachers will learn more about these issues, and they're going to actually help educate others who come to the case. So this is a really clever one that's ongoing. The visit to Camuy Caves happened last year, and they're collecting data and beginning to do this work. Another one I want to mention, which is not quite as far along, but is an interesting one as well. It's one happening here primarily in Florida. It's on phenology and climate change. Our partner in this is George Kitch, who is a climate scientist, really a biologist at the U.S. Geological Survey Office here in the Tampa Bay area. The graduate students of geology, graduate student Megan Lindsay, she's working on her PhD in geoscience education, and we have two educators at Stewart Middle School here in Tampa. And so we're involving the students and teachers here in documenting temperature, precipitation, and the occurrences of key plant and animal species at two locations within the Hillsborough River watershed, which is the local river basin. One is the Crystal Springs Preserve, which is a parkland upstream, and then one right behind the school. So it's a relatively easy thing for them to do. They're very close to Tampa Bay, so we can see upstream and downstream phenomena here. And they're getting some training or education on phenology as a tool and on climate change at Stewart Middle School. Students are getting training in plant and animal identification, and they're actually going to be doing some of these observations themselves, both in the parks during field trips and on their own, and then develop the ideas that they will develop at the end, a portfolio of maps of plant and animal distribution data and life cycle data for the different species studied. So at the end, it's trying to connect the students to the science of, in this case, the science of organismal biology here that is being impacted by climate. So again, not quite as far along as the other one, but an interesting project nonetheless. All right, so let me move on now to another stakeholder audience that we're talking to, which is that audience of professionals, what we call the built environment professional audience. Okay, why do this? Well, one objective certainly is addressing a need, and this is a stated need. We didn't so much go to the urban planners and other folks in this professional community as they came to us. They really are, this is a group of people that really crave detailed, place-based educational content and information content that they can use to make decisions and give effective advice regarding what goes on in the urban environment. I mean, urban planners are responsible for everything from the siting of buildings to the management of water resources to where sewer lines are laid to all that brass tack stuff that makes the city work. They're the folks who provide the permitting processes. They're the ones who project out how is the city going to grow, how are we going to use our land. This is their job, and they need to know how that map is changing as a function of climate change, okay, both in terms of sea level, as well as rainfall, as well as hazardous weather events. They want data. They want information. They want to know how to work with that information. Okay. Now the other thing, which is a sort of secondary strategy, it's really an effort to find other community messengers on this issue. Okay. I mean, if you think about the sort of doubtful three in the Laserwood Six Americas, a lot of the folks at that end of the spectrum have a distrust of academics. You hear this in the news, but you hear this across the spectrum here. I've seen studies where they're talked about as hierarchical individualists, and they have certain people who are authority figures, and those are the folks they believe, and other people they don't give serious credence to. But the other part of this problem, of course, is that, and there are other studies supporting this idea, which is that the more complicated a problem is, and climate change is an extremely complicated, interconnected, sort of global-scale problem. The more complicated the issue is, the more likely it is that citizens will tune it out and not believe authorities on this issue. Okay, so the academics, the climate scientists, the researchers may have very good information and they are recognized as the experts, but the perception of the public is, oh, this is such a mess, even they can't know. All right? And that just causes them to ignore it, and then we don't lose their attention. Our hope is that by having more messengers, by having folks who are brass tacks in decision-making in cities, by having these kinds of people really informed about climate change and what needs to be done and making the decisions and doing things in this regard, we will get better subscribership to the issue overall and a more attentive general public audience eventually because of this. In the short term, we just got to do it because these folks need the help, but with any luck at all, this will help actually convince some of the doubtful folks in the public that, hey, maybe this isn't so nuts. That, you know, if the guys who are telling us where we're putting buildings and sewers are saying we've got to deal with this, we probably should deal with this. Now, I will say that we did not do this on our own, and there's probably no way on earth we could have gotten this done on our own, because we just don't speak the same language as these kinds of professionals. As an academic, I don't have any idea what they do, and they have no idea what I do. And so we actually went out and identified consultants who could help us work with this. And we have one key consulting liaison who I want to give credit to here, which is a local firm called Sunshine State Strategies, LLC, here in the Tampa Bay area, who have been exceptional in helping us do handshakes with the planning community, with business communities, and other professional communities that we need to regarding this issue. Okay, so on to the next slide. Focus mostly in the phase one effort on work for urban and regional planning professionals. That's where we've spent most of our time. And we've established a network of partners in this realm who are keen to work with us on this. The American Planning Association Florida chapter, which is a membership organization, piece of the National American Planning Association, but there are 2,800 members in Florida, so it covers a lot of ground in terms of the planning community. We've worked with the U.S. chapter of ICLEI, which is Local Governments of Sustainability. It's an activist organization that provides information and support to municipalities on climate change and other issues related to sustainability. We are working with one of the 12 regional planning councils in the state of Florida, the Southwest Florida Regional Planning Council. They are our liaison into the broader sort of policy-level planning community. We're actually working with a private firm here, HOK Incorporated. It's an architectural design and planning firm. They're the private sector connection here, and we have a direct academic partner involved here, which is the Florida State University Department of Urban and Regional Planning. Faculty from that department have been involved in all of our conversations in this regard. And I do want to mention one other key academic strategic partner that's involved both in the planning end of things and also from the policy perspectives. A longstanding organization here in the state that's been doing good things on climate and sustainability, the Florida Center for Environmental Studies at FAU. Okay, so what are we doing with the planning professionals? Moving on to the next slide here. Our goal is to strengthen and standardize their knowledge of climate change, of the mitigation adaptation strategies that they can use across the region. They want that brass tacks knowledge, okay? So right now, as part of our phase one effort, we are conducting surveys of that community to assess both their education and information needs and also how they can learn about this. And this is an important consideration when we're talking about folks who are, you know, in the workaday life as professionals. Where can they go? How can they go and get this kind of content and this kind of information? We need to know how to deliver it to them. The pre-survey went out. It's being formatively assessed and slightly tweaked now, and then the larger survey is actually, I think, heading out the door here in the next few days or so to gather information from that larger group of planners in the state. Within this survey, there are questions that will help us define geographic or regional needs to move us toward really being able to provide place-based content, relative climate change education content, to the audiences in our region. And that's very important because the issues, for example, down in Miami, where you're basically a yard above sea level in most places, are somewhat different than the issues up here in Tampa, where there are places that low, but a lot of the city sits a little bit higher. So there's stuff that's going to be acute in Miami that's not acute in Tampa. There's stuff that's going to be acute in Tampa that's not going to be an issue in Jacksonville. And so to be able to, you know, we want to be able to give them what they want for the place they're in and be able to granularize some of this information, taking advantage of the scientific work that's been done in the state on climate change and its impacts to give them what they need, really to help repurpose this stuff for their best benefit. We're working to network this community on this issue to help them with information sharing and professional development and cooperation. And obviously, there is a conscious effort to develop a targeted education plan that will involve both in-service training of professional planners to help them, you know, to give them what they need in terms of climate change. Also, pre-service, if you like, in graduate school training of urban planners, which is what budding urban planners, which is what the FSU folks are very interested in, both to improve what they're doing academically as students come out the door, but also to think about certification, because planners, like many professionals, are licensed, and they actually have a certification examination they need to take. And content that makes its way into the graduate classroom eventually makes its way onto the certification exams. There's a move to have more climate-related content built into that exam, and so there's a feedback loop potential here for really engendering the necessity for this information, and therefore the driver to be the driver to have this information to get educated about it within this community. Okay. Next slide, just what activities we've been doing with the professionals and the planners. Some events we've done in the past, we had back in May a downtown partnership, downtown debrief. The Tampa Bay Downtown Partnership is a consortium of all the major businesses in the Tampa Bay area, Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater. We have a metro area of about 3 million people here, and so it's a consortium of all the major businesses in that region. They invited us to be part of a panel discussion on climate change. It was a breakfast time discussion. Very interesting, giving a talk on climate change to lawyers and bankers and folks like that. But very, very well received. Got a lot of good feedback from the community and a lot of interest in what we're doing. We were co-sponsors of the APA Florida Annual Conference this past year. The American Planning Association is their professional organization. They have a regional conference. We had exhibits, and we had, you know, a lot of time to pull people over and have discussions about our goals and what they need and sort of begin to frame out the survey effort that we were putting forward. And most recently, we had a brainstorming meeting looking over the pre-survey results and strategizing about what needs to come out next and what an education plan for this community should look like, which was in association with the APA Executive Committee meeting that happened here in Orlando just really a few days ago. Okay. Upcoming, we have a couple big events that we're engaged in with our planning partners. One is the second annual Coastal City Summit in St. Petersburg, Florida. There are a series of catchy sponsored sessions on climate change impacts that will involve our planning partners. This is an audience, again, of urban professionals, urban policymakers, to sort of get out in front of those folks and sort of tie the knot with the professionals and the policy folks within the urban settings on these issues. And then the next big event, which is regional in scale, which is not just statewide, but actually national in scale, Risk and Response, the Sea Level Rise Summit, that is happening. It's going to be in Orlando. It will be the 21st and 22nd of December, of June this year. The lead partner, the lead organization on this is actually the Florida Center for Environmental Studies, and we are co-sponsoring and planning education sessions with them on this effort. So this has gotten to be a really vital piece of what we're doing with a very, very engaged and interested audience. Now on to the next slide, which talks about some of our activities in informal education. And largely these activities have been data gathering activities and sort of assaying communities. The Florida Aquarium has been our lead partner, obviously, in engaging with the informal science venues across the state. There is a network, sort of an informal network of these venues, and we had a workshop for them. Hello? I'm getting weird feedback here.
Yeah, the rest of us are too, Jeff. I think it's fine, though.
Okay.
Continue.
Okay, I'm going to try here. We had a workshop for this informal community on the 15th of April back in 2011. Keynote speaker was actually a climate scientist from Eckerd College, and again, this was a place where we had a needs and assay their needs and try to gather some information. We've also were part of a cooperative effort with the COSI Florida Project, which is a Consortium for Ocean Science Education Excellence Project. This is based out of Fort Pierce over on the East Coast to do a communicating climate change to informal audiences, a joint workshop with them back in August. What came out of our surveys of informal educators? I don't know what's going on with this beep, but
sounds like a battery issue.
It sounds like it, which I don't understand. But the results of this were a little disturbing. Very little is being presented on climate change, irrespective of venue. So talking to nature centers, zoos, science centers across the state, we're just not seeing a whole lot done. And part of the reason, apparently, is because there's not a lot of good, relevant, place-based science content for these informal educators to work with. They are really suffering for this lack of appropriate content, and climate scientists work to vet it. Okay? We have a second informal educators workshop coming up here in March, and we're going to obviously continue to gel this. Going on, to give a few focus words on what we're doing in the Caribbean. Okay? Our lead partners here, obviously, are the University of Puerto Rico, Mayagüez, who gives the central organization in something called the COHEMIS Consortium, which is actually a consortium, a longstanding consortium of science leaders, scientists, and educators across the Caribbean Basin and into South America. So it's a Spanish-speaking consortium of scientists and interested parties. So they give us long thread into that community, which is great. And also the University of Virgin Islands is involved with us specifically on the tourist industry. We have one strategic partner who's been very nice to have, Inter-American Development Bank. It's nice to be partners with a bank. They pay for stuff. And obviously out in the Caribbean, there's some stuff we can't pay for working with foreign nationals and foreign countries, but the IDB is very interested in climate change issues in the Caribbean and is happy to work with us on this. We're also working closely with the Puerto Rico Sea Grant, an organization which is connected through UPR, and with the Caribbean Community Climate Change Center, which is part of the CARICOM Consortium of English-speaking Caribbean nations. Okay, so actually their science advisor is on our advisory committee, and we've been involved with activities with them. And most recently, we've gotten involved with the Caribbean Tourism Organization, helping them with events they're doing, and also connecting, again, with the tourism industry professionals, with policy professionals, and informal and formal educators in these nation in the U.S. territories, but also really all across the region. What have we accomplished in our Caribbean ventures? One important thing we accomplished is we did a Spanish translation of the Interagency Climate Literacy Document. Okay, we have a working Spanish translation. We actually sent it to Frank Niepold at NOAA. He was, I think, somewhat surprised to get it. Haven't heard back on anything. He's apparently put it into the channels to be vetted, but we're using it. So we do have this. If anybody wants access to it, we can provide it. It's a really necessary thing for us, not just for the Caribbean, not just for Puerto Rico, but for large audiences in Florida and along the Gulf. I mean, we have a lot of Spanish speakers in this part of the world, and so having this kind of documentation is really necessary. We have run events through UPR, several of them at this point, Foro de Cambio Climático, which was co-sponsored by CACI and COHEMIS. We've done several of these events, one back in February of last year, another one in March, and then another one in September, aimed at educators, scientists, really trying to bring a lot of these communities together to talk about issues related to climate change and how to get more public engagement and understanding of the issue. We have also had CACI executive team members invited by the Inter-American Development Bank to present on our project and on climate change and Caribbean adaptation strategies at a number of meetings that the Inter-American Development Bank has sponsored in Guatemala, Trinidad, Guyana, and most recently Sweden. I'm not sure how that tied in, but they asked and we went. So upcoming, we have quite a number of things happening in the Caribbean. Working with our audiences there. We have a large international climate forum that is scheduled, actually will happen the first 3 days of February. It is going to happen in Mayagüez, sponsored by CACI, by COHEMIS, and by the Inter-American Development Bank. We are going to be putting on a climate change workshop for Virgin Island tourism professionals in April. The dates haven't been fully pinned, but that's coming in April of this year. And we are a part of the Caribbean Tourist Organization's Sustainable Tourism Conference, which will also happen in April of this year. We have a number of sponsored sessions there, again, doing this at their invitation. So, CACI for Phase 2. Are we going to go forward in Phase 2? Oh, yeah. In fact, our letter of intent went in, which, of course, is a placeholder. What I will say about Phase 2 for CACI is that the discussions are ongoing about what it's going to look like and how it's going to scale. I mean, the time step we're working on is so tight, but at the same time, we have to have the gel has to be right. It has to fit together well. And I guess central in our thinking so far are really a couple things. First, this idea of place-based relevant content, okay? We've gotten this from every audience we've talked to. There is a real problem of not granular enough climate education content for the needs of the audiences in this part of the world, and we're clearly going to be addressing that in some manner or other. We have to, okay? There's a great desire by all of the audiences you've talked to have more direct contact with and interaction with climate scientists. In other words, to get the educators and the scientists together for a conversation across those divides so that the educators can really understand what matters in their place and the climate scientists can understand what's needed in these different places along the in these coastal environments. And also, we want to, you know, obviously, if we want to be phase two, we have to be part of the CSEP Alliance, and we want to work with all others who have interest in human issues of the coastlines, especially for climate change, because to some degree, Florida is the canary in the coal mine, okay? Things are going to happen here. I say going to happen here. Things are happening here now, okay? Structures put in to control flooding in South Florida are not working now. They can't move floodwaters around now because of this. They're losing water resources now because of this. Things are happening now, and what's happened recently is more recently is that folks are beginning to recognize, no, this is sea level rise, this is climate, this is rainfall pattern changes, this is all related, and what can we do? And so we're out there in front of what's going to be a big change, and obviously people need that information. They need to know what's coming, why it's coming, and what they can do about it. And we see that as something, you know, if we're going to do phase two, we have to be able to provide good support there. So with that, I'll end and ask for any questions or comments or the like from y'all. Thanks again.
Thanks so much, Jeff. Great presentation. Any questions for Jeff?
It sounds like this is Karen Holwig. It sounds like you're doing a tremendous amount with really diverse audiences and interesting combinations of audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand the focus on relevance and today, what's happening, and being able to respond to current conditions. What I'm wondering, as someone who is not in that kind of a setting,
mm-hmm.
is whether that immediacy and urgency leads to people being any more concerned about today, what I'm doing today to generate greenhouse gases or not.
And I don't have an answer to that question. Our hope, and certainly if there's a research question in this, and in a lot of what we've done is to what degree can connecting with this issue in one way help them understand aspects of it in another?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a fundamental issue in a lot of STEM education, right? It's can an activity in a classroom, for example, a particular activity, help them learn the whole karmic substance of what happens in the class? Does it help engage them more? Obviously, our hypothesis is that it might. But part of this is also just practical necessity. It's very hard to talk to an audience about greenhouse gases when their homes are being flooded. And it's really hard to get them to think long-term when short-term is essentially catastrophic. And so part of this is also, let's avoid the catastrophe and provide the information so that when the catastrophe has passed and they're still alert to the issue, we can actually start to have more conversations about some of these longer-term issues. It's almost impossible in this area, in this part of the world, to get past this immediacy. Because, these are not issues of tomorrow or even the next day. Things are happening now. People are being affected by them now. And, you know, we've had our storm events. I mean, Katrina and Rita made a big fuss on the Gulf Coast over on the other side of the Gulf, but both of those hurricanes hit, you know, those hurricanes hit Florida too. And so these kinds of events and the vulnerability we have to them, that's where you can get people's attention. It's also where they're focused. And so in order to get them to take a longer view picture, we've got to get past the short view. And so there's a bit of it that's an experiment, I guess, and the other part of it is just the necessity of giving, you know, is developing trust with that audience, the audiences we have, and getting them to a point that they can actually listen to these other arguments. Does that help?
It amazes me.
it's a huge, I mean, it's a big problem down here, and horrifying is that people are really not that aware.
God, even with it happening around them.
Yeah. If not in Florida, where? I mean, how do we do it in other parts of the country?
I know. And it's just, and there's, I mean, if anything, I mean, I look at things I know are happening on the West Coast, and I look here, and I just say, oh, my God, you know, because it's tomorrow. Now, having said that, obviously, down in South Florida, we have something called the Core County Compact, which is planners, municipalities, politicians, everybody has gotten together and realized, okay, we got a problem. And so they have made conscious efforts to coordinate what they're doing across the four southernmost counties of the state to get ready for what is really happening. I mean, you know, the two longest tide gauge records in the nation, I think even in the world, are Miami and Key West. And so there's really no arguing with what those tide gauges have been telling us. And and as I've said in a few sessions when I've done on these things, I said, you know, scientists argue models all the time. Okay, models are how scientists sort of frame discussion, and we debate models a lot. However, you know, a tide gauge is basically a ruler stuck in the ground that measures the height of the water, and it's really hard to argue a ruler. So, you know, I think that's also something that the professional audiences really, really grab onto. The two issues that get them is, okay, what's really hard and fast? Because when they hear people talk about climate models, the eyes glaze over and it gets complicated for them. But you say, no, we've measured water levels for 200 years and they're showing us this, then they pay attention. Mm-hmm. The other thing that they pay attention to, and this is the language that I as an academic and my academic colleagues don't speak, but an urban planner, for example, does, is how much will it cost you to do nothing, and how much will it cost you to do the things that might, you know, save your investment? That gets their attention.
Yeah.
Scott?
Yeah.
I have two items. I don't know how long we're going to go here. It's on the top of the hour.
We can certainly go for a few minutes. People can leave if they need to.
So my first of all, really marvelous presentation. So I have two questions. I'll put them both to you and then wait. One is that communication to the public around challenging issues. I was very interested in the social science dimensions of that, and I just wanted to, confirm if I heard you say this phrase, hierarchical individualism. Was that the term you used?
I may have the term wrong. I'm getting this from my education colleagues, but that's a term that they used or something like that to me in describing this kind of person who is very authority-driven, but they pick who the authority figure is, and that person is not necessarily somebody of a different mindset. So if you like, it's the same phenomenon that gets conservatives to watch Fox News and liberals to watch MSNBC, if you want to use the television analogy. So people go, and I saw this actually, it was in the New York Times, people are going for their information to sources which agree with their predispositions, and folks who are in this more hierarchical mindset apparently do that more than most.
No, that was helpful, a very interesting piece of the challenge that we've been talking about over a couple of years in the network here. The other part is, I wonder if you could just say a word, is Haiti involved at all? I have been dealing with the Inter-American Development Bank that you cited because of some work in the Haiti, Sustainable Future of Haiti. Are they implied in any of the networks you've been dealing with?
Haiti is involved. Well, obviously, IADB works with Haiti. So there are some Haitian folks who come to those events. We've invited Haitians to our Puerto Rico event upcoming here. One of the challenges with Haiti, of course, is that after the earthquake, it pretty much shut the place down. And so the contacts one would normally have there were, as our project was starting, we're still not really back yet. COHEMIS, I can't remember if Haiti is part of the COHEMIS consortium, but it might well be, because it's not, while it is dominated by Spanish-speaking countries, it does include French Guiana and Suriname and countries like that as well. So Haiti may actually be wired, it may be connected in that way. They haven't been as proactive in involving themselves in some of these discussions through the Puerto Rico, our Puerto Rico partners, that is, as others. Interestingly, one of the countries that has been very engaged is Cuba, which clearly we can't spend a dime on, but they are very interested in what's happening here.
Thank you.
Jeff, could we have your contact info?
Oh, did I not do that?
I came in late.
Oh, okay. Let's see. I'm at University of Florida. I didn't even put that on the advertising.
Well, I can add it to the website.
Yeah.
I can do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be great. But it's basically my email address is ryan@mail, M-A-I-L, .usf.edu. The other way to get me is through the Catchy website, www.catchy.net, because I'm linked through there.
Thank you.
That's great. Any other questions for Jeff? I know we're over time a little bit here, but thanks again, Jeff. It's a great presentation, as several people have already said. Really covers a lot of really interesting stuff. So I'm so glad that you guys are doing this work. I also want to mention for folks, next week we have a presentation and discussion that Tamara is going to do on the kinds of things that CLEAN can provide to some of the CSEP 2 proposals. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of the things that CLEAN, in terms of its review and how we look at different kinds of resources and how that may be of value to some of the projects that are going forward. As Jeff alluded, the letter of intent for those projects was due today, so I'm sure several of them have gone in, and full proposals are due in March. So there'll be a discussion next week about that. Tamara, I believe, is going to lead that, and hope that folks can join us.
Okay.
And that's a wrap for today. Thanks again, Jeff. Really, really appreciate this.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Happy to have
you.
Great. Bye to everyone.
Hey,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.